Single Greatest Choice podcast, where we dive into the topics of singleness, fertility, motherhood, and choice. I'm your host, Katie B. Every episode, I'll deliver conversations with women in their fertile years who are grappling with what to do when life doesn't turn out as planned. You will also hear interviews with experts in the fields of fertility, personal development, choosing single motherhood, and more. Join us as we explore these topics and support each other along the way. Because what you decide to do with these years could be the single greatest choice you'll ever make, and you don't have to make it alone. This week, I'm so excited to bring you guys a conversation with Krista, a single woman from Perth, Australia, whose story is beautiful and heartbreaking and inspiring all at once. Krista will charm you with her humor and her strength. A little trigger warning, Krista's story does involve pregnancy loss and stillbirth. So if that's a topic that's hard for you, you might want to skip this episode. But if you stick around, I know you'll find Krista every bit as inspirational as I did.
Hi, Krista. Thank you so much for joining us today. Would you start by just telling us a little bit about you?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for having me, Katie. It's an honor. I am from Perth, Western Australia. I am 33 at the moment. Started my journey when I was 30. I have got a dog, two cats, a fish, and a bird, because I really like animals. I have accumulated them all since I've been trying to conceive because my maternal side just really needs something to love.
So you said you started this journey at 30. Was there something that motivated you to start down this path at that point?
So it sort of started with a bit of a mental health breakthrough, I guess you could say. I had a really severe episode of depression where just after turning 30, I felt like my life wasn't really going anywhere. Probably like a lot of your listeners out there was feeling very alone and like I was never going to meet somebody. I kept doing the math in my head that was, okay, if I meet someone tomorrow, then I'll be X years old by the time you know, getting paid.
So familiar. We've all done that math.
Exactly. We've all done it. And I ended up just talking myself into a huge spiral and crashing with just complete belief that it was never going to happen, which it completely broke me. I didn't know how to change that. I didn't know how to fix that. Like everything just started to compound and I just completely crashed. But I got out of that. I got better. And through that healing process, I realized that the one thing I did want, which was to have a family, was something I could do on my own. I can't really pinpoint the exact moment I had that thought. It felt like it was just something that one day I woke up and was like, oh yeah, that actually feels quite comfortable to think about right now. So I started looking online for real life examples of women who had done this. And at first, when I was sort of just thinking about it, I was like, wow, this is a really like new and out there concept. And then I went online and found all these women. And I didn't really feel like I was paving the way in any kind of way at then. But I was also really glad because I guess it really cemented the fact for me that, yeah, it's possible. And yes, women can do this. And it's possible on a single income as a single woman. It's possible for people who own their houses, who don't own their houses, who have full-time jobs, who don't have full-time jobs. I think looking online and finding these real-life examples was really powerful because there were women from all walks of life. This wasn't a lifestyle that only favored like the rich and successful woman, you know, in her late 40s who had an amazing career.
Right.
It was just a really powerful time for me finding all these stories. So I started to dig deeper, you know, podcasts, Instagram accounts, articles. I reached out to a few women who had done it before or who were trying, have made some really good friends as well during this time.
I've definitely experienced the same. And it is beautiful to see that there is a lot of variety amongst the types of women who are making this choice. And we also have certain things in common. It does take a woman who really has a lot of self-belief and feels pretty empowered in order to move forward with this. It is a beautiful community. And I think every woman that I've talked to so far has brought up how the support of the community has been a piece of it for her. And so hopefully that's part of what we're fostering here is just, you know, this could be the conversation that some woman hears and decides, I think I can do this.
That's very true. And also, yeah, kind of inspiring, actually.
So you sought out that community and you found examples. And then from there, talk us through the next steps.
I'm a big researcher. I like to research everything. So I started looking at fertility clinics here in my home state. There's not many. There, I think my research turned up 3 that I was able to go through. And that was because not all the fertility clinics here offered donor sperm. So I definitely needed that. That was a very integral part of my plan. I very naively decided to go through treatment in a different state and set up my first Skype call with the fertility specialist.
And listeners may not know that the way that donor sperm works in different countries is very different. So if you're here in the US, we have access to lots of sperm banks with hundreds of men and can get the sperm within, I think, probably 24 hours. All you need is just your doctor's consent and then you're good to go. And will you tell us a little bit in Australia what it's like? Because it's very different there.
So it doesn't look anything like that. The biggest difference is because it's all altruistic over in Australia. So that means people can only make donations voluntarily. There's no monetary exchange. They don't get paid for anything. The donors are all known donors once the child turns 18, which means that their details are made available to the child should the child wish to obtain them.
What about family limits in Australia? Do you know how many families can use a donor?
Yeah, so family limits are another restricting factor on why there's not very much donor sperm available, and that's because here in Western Australia, a sperm donor can only assist 5 families. In South Australia, where I commenced my first lots of fertility treatment, that was 10 families. With the altruistic donation, the known donor position and the family limit, donor sperm is hard to come by.
Right. And when you chose a donor, how many choices did you have?
So I've switched donors quite a number of times. So for my first 2 IUIs, I think I had a choice of maybe 6 donors. So we get no photographs, no handwritten letters, no voice recordings. My first clinic, I got up to 4 pages of information. My second clinic, I got 2. It's physical characteristics and medical history, and that's about it. You don't really get any sort of insight into their personality. You certainly don't get any information on if there's been successful pregnancies or children prior to your use. It's very basic. So for me, I was looking for a donor who had similar physical characteristics. So skin color, hair color, eye color, who's got the best health history, and that's it.
Yep. So you chose your donor and then you started, it sounds like, with IUI?
Yes. This is where my being very naive came into it. I went into this journey assuming that my fertility was perfect, that I was going to have no problems. I was 30, you know, everyone told me you're young, you know, you're healthy, everything's going to be fine. But I guess it's been anything but since then. I did 5 IUI cycles over in Adelaide. 2 of those were cancelled because I overstimulated. So I only ever had 3 full cycles. They all came back negative.
And when you say you overstimulated, so were you using Clomid or letrozole or?
Yep. So all my cycles were medicated. I don't know why I never did an unmedicated cycle, actually, now that I'm thinking about that. My first cycle, I went in on Clomid and I ended up having, I think, 7 follicles. Yeah. So yeah, 2 cancelled IUIs, and that was because 2 of those were overstimmed and the other 3 were all negative. I also, when I first started this journey, was adamant that I was never going to do IVF. I assumed that I would just have to look at sperm and fall pregnant.
Yes.
And so, oh, I'm never going to do IVF because that stuff's, that's like full on and scary and really expensive, and I'm not going to need it anyway. It was a real shock to get through those IUIs and, yeah, have never seen a positive pregnancy test. In all my family, all my friends, I don't know anybody who had fertility issues. So it was just, you know, it was always something that happened to a friend of a friend. I didn't know anything about infertility. I didn't know anything about egg quality. I knew that people froze their eggs, but thought that was for like really old people to do. I just had absolutely no idea.
Right.
And it was probably my second or third IUI that I started to actually do some proper research into the medication, like the side effects, infertility issues, you know, what sort of problems I'm facing and why.
Well, and in reality, you know, looking at your situation, if you'd only done 3 medicated IUIs and hadn't gotten pregnant at that point, that's really not medically infertility at that point, right? I mean, if you were partnered and you came in and said, "Doctor, we've tried 3 months in a row and I'm still not pregnant," they would send you back home to keep trying. And so it's interesting how in our situation where we're paying so much per cycle, that those alarm bells start to go off much earlier just because of the expense of continuing to try. And I think in some ways it makes us feel worse about our body and our fertility and the possibilities. But in some ways it's better because we are moving to things like IVF and medication and things like that much earlier, when those could have been the inevitable end anyway, and we're just getting there a little bit faster.
Yes, absolutely. What you were saying about how, you know, we're so much more aware of our fertility so much earlier than an average couple who are trying naturally, because we get a lot more insight into our cycles. You know, we're finding out what our lining's doing. We're finding out what our hormones are doing. We're looking at the sizes of those follicles. You know, we're playing God in a way by saying, right, we're going to trigger at this stage. Mm-hmm. We're having, you know, all the tests and the tracking like throughout a cycle. So I think that, yeah, there are alarm bells a lot earlier because we're really controlling the situation so minutely that you expect results, because if you're controlling things, well, surely they're supposed to work, right?
Right. Oh, that's the worst. It's so controlled and yet completely out of our control.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't know how it felt for you, but for me, I kind of had that same feeling of, well, IVF is for people other than me. I'm not one of those people that's going to need IVF. And it just seemed so extreme. And now that I've gone down the path of IVF, I can't imagine going back to IUI, because I did get pregnant through an IUI and I had an early miscarriage. And the idea now that I would have a positive pregnancy and I wouldn't know anything about the health of that embryo or the quality of that egg, now that I'm on the other side where I have like PGS tested embryos and I know that all the chromosomes are there and everything, I'm like, why would you just, it's like the Wild West. Like, why would you ever not do IVF? You know?
Yeah, definitely. It absolutely blows my mind that people can fall pregnant without treatment. Like,
right.
What?
Right.
Babies are being born without any kind of intervention. What is this sorcery?
Okay. Yeah. So you did your 5 IUIs, and then tell us what happened after that.
I didn't even spend 5 minutes thinking about it. I just knew I was just going to go straight into IVF. It just felt like the right next step. It didn't matter that I was absolutely terrified. Spent all my money, like all my savings on IUIs, and used all my annual leave, like to be traveling. And it didn't matter that I basically had no means to make that happen. I just knew that I was going to make it happen. So, you know, this was a pretty big deal. And I'm taking out my retirement money to try and make a baby. But I was completely committed. I definitely wasn't ready to stop trying. Flew over to Adelaide. Was doing all my stim drugs, having regular scans and blood work. I ended up retrieving 9 eggs, but I didn't get any embryos. So that was absolutely soul crushing to have talked myself up into like being ready for this cycle, like mentally prepared myself for it, like had done this financial withdrawal, had taken more time off work, flown over to Adelaide and got nowhere. it was absolutely devastating. And I'm in a strange city, so I have no friends or family. I don't know. It was a real low point. I definitely was heartbroken. I jumped on the next plane home. I threw more money at an unplanned air ticket because I didn't want to be in Adelaide for, you know, an extra second. I had actually met an Instagram follower over there. She turned out to be an absolute lifeline during that. She came over straight away, like while I was packing, you know, just, I needed a hug. She gave me a hug because I just had no one else over there. And that was just the most beautiful thing of her to do. I was absolutely just devastated for days, like weeks even. I just never in my wildest dreams had I imagined that outcome. I think the other thing with IVF, you know, there's all these myths around it. And I went into IVF thinking, man, it's expensive, but it'll work.
Right.
I thought IVF was the answer to all infertility. And It was for the real game players, like the real serious people.
Right. And you've done the big thing, like you've pulled your money out of your retirement. You were all in.
Yeah. So, that definitely threw me back a few steps. But again, I just knew I wasn't ready to stop. I had wisened up at this point though and decided to switch to a local clinic. I could not afford to keep going over to Adelaide. And I think as well, the hard thing is when I first started trying, I'd imagined, you know, sort of having a baby by the next Christmas. And so there were all these milestones passing in the meantime. And it's such a mental game as well as a physical game going through fertility treatment that it's really important to be able to look after your mental well-being at the same time. And I definitely wasn't doing that at this stage. I was just champing at the bit, wanting to go, go, go. And eventually I had to sort of just stop and regroup and get back to reset. So we went into IVF number two. From that, I ended up with two embryos. My new clinic here in Perth prefers to do day three transfers fresh, and they do frozen 5-day transfers when the embryos get to blastocyst. So I had my very first transfer and I was so excited. Again, I just assumed it was going to work because, oh my God, I finally got an embryo inside me for the first time ever. It didn't take. Spoiler alert, didn't work. That was a big disappointment again because being my first transfer, I just assumed that the embryo would implant, but it didn't. My next transfer was my frozen embryo from that cycle. So I only had the one frozen. Frozen transfer didn't work. That was also a negative. It was around this time I realized I didn't like my doctor very much. He had absolutely terrible bedside manner. And I was really struggling with the idea of going through another cycle with him because I'd go into an appointment, he'd sort of talk at me, not to me. I got no answers. I never felt like he was explaining things to me properly. I didn't feel like he was giving me a chance. At one point, he made a comment about how I was single and I needed to stop spending money on fertility treatment.
Okay, listeners, if you're listening to this and you're not happy with your doctor, please, please, please find a different one. That's a huge part of my story too. Did you find another clinic?
I stayed at the same clinic, but I switched doctors, okay, which definitely raised a few eyebrows within the clinic. And I felt so awkward about doing, but I'd now been through a year and a half of treatment, 5 IUIs, 2 IVFs, didn't feel like I was getting any closer to a successful pregnancy. I'd never even had a positive test. I put my big girl pants on and I switched doctors.
Good for you.
Yeah. Definitely worth it. I love my new doctor. She sat down with me and my first appointment with her, she talked with me for over an hour and just explained everything, told me things that the other doctors had never even mentioned. She was open to experimental drugs and trials. She didn't dismiss anything I had to say, wrote me up a completely different protocol, put me on some experimental drugs that were having great success over in America, but were very new here in Australia. that required, you know, FDA approval and a whole heap of extra paperwork, but she was just lovely. And we had a very successful cycle. So with her, we retrieved only 6 eggs, but I ended up on day 3 with 3 embryos. They were all very poor quality again. But the embryologist called and said that her recommendation would be to put 2 embryos back. The embryologist had the support of my doctor to do that. This call came in like at the 11th hour. I'm just getting in the car to drive up to the clinic for a transfer. Multiple embryos can mean multiple babies. Right. And as a single woman, that's definitely like a big decision to make. But I said yes. I just was willing to try anything and everything. And my whole motto for that cycle was, I'm all in, to jump backwards a little bit. Leading up to this cycle, I took 6 months off fertility treatments. I worked with a naturopath, acupuncturist, massage therapist, and a yoga teacher to specifically improve my fertility and my egg quality, to improve my lining, to improve my cycles, to work on my stress and my mindfulness, to make sure that I was nice and calm for when it got to time for a transfer. I basically did everything. I changed my diet, I changed my exercise, I was on like 1,000 supplements. I really was just going all in. And the reason that I chose to go all in was because it was going to be my last cycle. By this stage, I'd done 3 withdrawals out of my superannuation. I was getting ready to put my house on the market because I'd spent all my money. Fertility is not cheap. And doing it on my own on a single income, yeah, it's hard. So I also wanted to get to the end of the cycle and not ask what if. I wanted to be comfortable in knowing that I had really tried everything. I went into that cycle half believing that it wasn't going to work, but also half believing and hoping that it would. So I was preparing myself for both outcomes mentally. If it didn't work, you know what? I can say I gave it everything and I tried it all. If it did work, I can be like, awesome, doing everything worked.
Right.
So yes, got to the 11th hour, the embryologist has called, we'd like to do a double transfer. I gave my consent to proceed with that. To put the 2 best embryos back in. When I say my 2 best embryos, they were still very poor quality. They didn't have the correct number of cells. They had quite a bit of fragmentation. They had gone through the reverse cleavage process, which is also not very good for resulting embryo quality. But I was like, no, let's do it. Mm-hmm. And it worked. I had my very first positive. I was over the moon, equally also scared shitless, because I'd done a double embryo transfer, right. And oh my God, what if it's twins? So I tracked my HCG numbers very closely online on the Vita calculators, because multiples, generally you'll have a higher HCG. My numbers were hovering in between like too high for a single, but too low for a double. I had my first scan, must have been around 6 or 7 weeks, and got to hear the heartbeat, and it was just 1. So that was amazing. I couldn't believe it. Just to be able to see that heartbeat on the screen is really magical. Like you lie there and the money doesn't matter. The hormones don't matter. Like all the medication doesn't matter. Over the 3 years, like I've gained quite a bit of weight. Didn't matter. Nothing. There was just nothing in the world that mattered. It was all it was about was just about that baby and that heartbeat. And my mom and my sister came with me. My sister was pregnant at that stage, and then I was pregnant. And yeah, it was fantastic. So yeah, really exciting stuff.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, every week was a milestone. That, you know, every week you're still pregnant in those first trimester, scary. And I had quite a bit of early bleeding, and so that was terrifying. But I was also having regular scans because of the bleeding, and each time everything was fine. I admitted into emergency a few times because I had hyperemesis, which is like very severe morning sickness. I ended up losing 8 kilos over 9 weeks, very rapid weight loss because I couldn't keep anything down. But Bubs was fine. Like, all of my ultrasounds were perfect. I did a early non-invasive prenatal testing, which showed that I was having a baby girl and that all my chances of chromosomal abnormalities were low. So they test for 3 different chromosomes and they were all low risk. Everything was going really well. And I was very happy.
Yeah. I think this is around the time that I started following you on Instagram, because I remember a post that you had, very cute, kind of sitting by the toilet with a little sign that said, what did it say? They said there'd be glowing or something
they
like that.
They said there's glowing. There was no glowing. They lied. I did not glow.
No, I think that was the very first post of yours that I saw. And I was immediately hooked to the humor and on the bathroom floor.
But, you know, I also really struggled. I was really struggling actually through that time because I had expected glowing. It was going to be amazing. And I was pregnant.
And you'd been through so much. You deserve glowing. Like, you deserved to have glowing at that point. The universe owed you glowing.
Yes, damn you. Yeah, I just distinctly remember just saying over and over again, pregnancy sucks. Like, this is not fun. I had wanted it for so long that I really struggled with that mindset as well. Like, it became a real like mental challenge to be able to say, it's actually okay that you're not enjoying this. Like, yes, you've wanted it. It's okay you're not enjoying it. It doesn't mean you deserve it any less. I hit 14 weeks and the hyperemesis started to drop off. I was still really ill all the time, but did get to a point where I was starting to enjoy it. The bleeding had also stopped by that stage. I ended up going in for my anatomy scan just before 19 weeks and everything was fine, except they found that my bub had bilateral talipes, which is club feet. So both of her feet were turned in. They also found that her hands looked slightly deformed. They couldn't be 100% certain on her hands because it could also been that her hands were just hidden from view. And I was due to follow up a week later with another ultrasound just to confirm the things that they couldn't see properly. Unfortunately, I never made it to that ultrasound. So just before 20 weeks, I was in the office at work and I felt that something wasn't right downstairs. So it felt to me as though, and this might get a little bit TMI, a bit graphic, it felt as though I had put a tampon in incorrectly. And so I just had a real discomfort and I knew straight away that wasn't right. So I went to emergency again, but I just honestly believed that everything was going to be okay because all throughout the pregnancy so far, the bleeding and the hyperemesis, and at one stage they couldn't find a heartbeat on the Doppler and I'd had an emergency scan, and that everything always worked out to be just fine. There was nothing to lead me to think that it wasn't going to be okay this time either. You know, I was nearly 20 weeks, second trimester, you're past the like the concerning stage. When I got to the hospital, yeah, everything just started to collapse from there. So I presented to triage, and normally, you know, it takes a while for you to be able to go through and see a doctor. In this case, they called me through straight away. They asked if they could do the Doppler to see if they could find the heartbeat. And I said, yeah, of course. Like, I love hearing the heartbeat. And I was still really upbeat and quite excited to know that I was going to hear the heartbeat. As I was walking into the ward, a doctor came through and said, we're going to go straight to ultrasound. We're not going to do the Doppler. I knew straight away that that wasn't good news. He did the ultrasound and baby girl was there and kicking and everything was fine. And he said, you know, that's really positive. She's there, she's moving, she's really active. But unfortunately, your cervix has dilated and the membrane has started to come through. Mm. So at that stage, I was 2 centimetres dilated. They explained what could happen from there. So I needed to have a further ultrasound that was more detailed and in depth. And basically the best outcome would be complete bed rest for the rest of the pregnancy. and putting in a stitch, a cerclage, that was going to be the best outcome. And I completely broke down at that because, as I've already mentioned, I have a lot of animals and I'm singles. And one, I needed someone to look after the animals if I was going to be on bed rest. Two, that meant no income for the remaining 20 weeks of my pregnancy. Three, like I've got a whole house. Like it just was the complete end of the world. You know, even though in hindsight, I would give anything to be on bed rest right now. But I mean, at the time, I just thought that was the end. The detailed ultrasound revealed that the amniotic sac hadn't fused properly. So I had two sacs. It's a bit confusing, this part. This part I get very confused over because I don't quite understand it properly. The ultrasound revealed that there were chromosomal abnormalities with Stella and with how my amniotic sac had formed, as well as the fact that too much of the membrane had come down through the cervix and was now sitting within my vaginal cavity. So one, a cerclage wasn't going to be possible because it would mean puncturing that membrane and then all the amniotic fluid leaving. But two, because the pregnancy was no longer viable due to the chromosomal abnormalities that they found, they weren't legally able to intervene. They basically said the pregnancy had to run its natural course, and that was a stillbirth. At that stage, Bub still had a heartbeat and was perfectly fine. Everything was okay, but they wouldn't let me come home. There were concerns for infection because my cervix had dilated and infection coming in. They also said that from what they could see, it was estimated that I would be giving birth within like 24 hours to a couple of days. And the best place for me in that regard was in hospital so that I could be on a birthing suite as soon as my waters broke. Oh. Yes. A couple of hours later, I was put on the ward. And yeah, basically I just had to wait for my body to go into labor on its own. I was given the option to take medication to bring on labor, but I chose not to do that.
What a hard decision.
It was a very hard decision. Part of my reasoning was that the nurses and doctors had explained to me that if I did go into labor sort of relatively soon and had my daughter, who I named Stella, if I had Stella then, she would be born alive but may only live for a couple of minutes. And I really struggled with that idea, knowing that she would be born living and then die. I wanted her to pass over while she was still inside my womb, where for me it felt, you know, she knew, she was safe, she was warm, she was comfortable. The doctors had explained that due to the cervix opening, she wouldn't last very long, so she would be passing at some stage. It ended up being around 48 hours later, so that my waters broke and I ended up giving birth. During that time, I didn't sleep a wink at all. I just could not sleep. And I spent that time researching, I guess, like the rights of a child at what gestation can they get a birth certificate? Are they recognised as being a person? That occurs at 20 weeks exactly. I went into hospital at 19 and 6, so I had 24 hours to wait, and that became a huge focus and a huge goal for me because I really wanted Stella's life to be acknowledged. I felt very strongly that having a birth certificate for her would mean that she existed and it wouldn't be like she was never here. And I've still to this day really struggle to explain just how much that meant to me to reach 20 weeks, but it was very important to me and I did it.
It makes sense to me. That's beautiful. I'm so glad that that tiny little grace was bestowed upon you and your just heartbreaking story.
Yeah. I fought really hard for that. So you know, with each hour, my membranes were coming through, my cervix was dilating even more. Every time I had to go to the toilet, I was absolutely terrified because I could just feel that she wanted to come. But I really fought hard. And in the end, we got to 20 and one. So a full extra day with her, which I just consider myself so lucky to have had that extra time with her. Before my waters broke at 7 o'clock in the evening, I went into full labour. So I had contractions, very painful contractions. And 5.5 hours later at 25 past midnight, I gave birth. I had had an ultrasound that afternoon at 4 o'clock and she was still with us. My next ultrasound was at 10 o'clock and she had passed. So somewhere in those 6 hours, she had passed. The doctors and the nurses were amazing. They were very kind, supportive. They were informative. Like, I knew exactly what was happening, what medications I was being given. There was never a decision made without my knowledge or consent. I was told I could stay in the hospital for as long as I needed, as long as I wanted. They were just fantastic. After I gave birth, I wasn't able to pass the placenta, which is very common for early gestation, preterm labour. I had to have a DNC. So that occurred a few hours later. Went into theatre and had that done. And then the next 2 days after I spent in hospital, I was able to have Stella with me for as long as I wanted during that time. She was perfect. You know, even at, 20 weeks and not full gestation, she was fully formed, 10 fingers, 10 toes. She had hair, she had eyelashes. You know, she's got a tiny little nose. People who I've shared photos with have commented that she looks like me, which is just the kindest thing anyone can say.
You've shared photos of her on your Instagram account, and I think it's just so beautiful that you've allowed this thing to be both hard and beautiful. You know, that you've found a way to celebrate her and recognize her existence and her presence in your life and grieve her very publicly in just such a beautiful way.
Sharing her photos was huge for me. The very first photo of her I shared was of her feet. Her feet were just adorable. She had these little button toes, and because she had the talipes, they were turned in, but they were just so perfect. And I have a necklace with her footprint on it. But the response I got from sharing that photo was amazing. People were so supportive. I just loved that other people were loving her. Other people were saying her name. You know, she was making an impact on other people's days. And that encouraged me to share another and another. And I think that it's been a very powerful part in my grieving. The grief journey has been really hard. After I gave birth, I fell into a massive depression and spent another 2 weeks in a mental health facility because I just felt like my life was over. I had fought for so many years to have a child and to have that dream come true in a pregnancy and then so cruelly ripped away from me at 20 weeks when everything up until that point had been perfect. There was zero indication that my pregnancy wouldn't be viable. It was just such a shock and it completely broke my heart. Like, my heart is still broken and it feels like Stella has taken a piece of my heart away with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to share with us some of the ways that you have just so beautifully kind of kept her memory alive? You've shared some things on Instagram, different photos, and maybe that would be helpful for someone else who is just trying to find a way to commemorate their own loss.
Yeah, definitely. In the first few weeks of losing Stella, I felt really empty in not being able to hold her, not being able to touch. That tangible connection was something that I really identified like missing, and it became really, really important to me to have something that I could touch and hold in her absence. So one of the first things I purchased were a couple of necklaces. So the first necklace I bought is a silver pendant in the shape of a teardrop that has a perfect print of her foot, and it's the same size of her actual foot, which is awesome. And that's quite a heavy pendant. I wanted something heavy that I could feel against my body, and it sits quite low. I then bought another couple of necklaces with her birth date and her initial, the letter S. They're in gold. I went and got a tattoo of her. So her name being Stella means star in Italian. That was a very conscious decision. Naming her Stella was because I knew she was, I didn't have a name before I got to the hospital. It was obviously still too early to be shortlisting names, but I knew that it would mean something to me in that she was becoming a star in the universe, you know, in passing on. I'm not religious. I don't not believe in heaven, but I also don't have the idea of heaven in my mind. Mm-hmm. I probably relate more to a spiritual side, and knowing that, you know, she was passing on into the universe and becoming a star just sat really nicely with me and my belief system. So the tattoo I've got is a star with the letter S inside and her birth date underneath. But it's not your typical 5-point star that you see everywhere. It's like a starburst.
It's beautiful. And I'll just break in. I want to make sure at some point that we connect people with your Instagram account, because you've got photos of the necklaces and of the tattoo, and you just have such a beautiful account in general. But if people want to connect with you and see photos of some of these things, will you share your Instagram handle?
Yes, it's project.pickle. So when I first started trying to conceive, I wanted a code name that I could talk to my friends or family or co-workers with that wasn't obvious. And Project Pickle was what we came up with. So yeah, so project.pickle will take you to my Instagram page, and that's where you'll see all the things I've done in trying to keep Stella's memory alive, not just for me, but for everybody. I just want people to know that stillbirth isn't anything to be ashamed of. It's not something that happens because you've done something wrong. It just happens. There's no, you know, there should be no stigma around it. Before I gave birth to Stella, I purposely looked up photos of preterm babies. I wanted to know what to expect. Whilst I completely hate the idea of this happening to anyone else, maybe, just maybe, me sharing this will help somebody else get through their journey of grief as well.
I definitely think it will. I so appreciate you being willing to be open with this. You're just doing such incredible work by your openness and the way that you share with humor and lightness, and then just very real, real heartbreak.
Thank you. It's definitely been a journey. There's been a lot of moments where I've hated being single, but there's also been a lot of moments where I've loved being single throughout this. It's definitely been a journey of highs and lows. It's a journey full of hope, of sadness, of frustration, of joy, trying to conceive, infertility, being single. It's a hard mix to get through, but it's possible. And even though I've experienced what I would consider to be the worst thing in life, that like the death of your child or losing a pregnancy, I know that I'm going to be okay. And Stella will live on forever in my heart and in my mind and in my memory. And I'm also not ready to stop trying. Stella she's made me a mum, but she's also given me confirmation that that is what I want. She's cemented that for me. Like, I now know more than anything that that's what I want. I want to be a mum.
She made you a mum.
Yes, she did. Yeah.
Oh, you've got me all teared up here. So I want to ask you this question kind of in general and then also specifically to grief and loss. What advice would you have for other women? And so just thinking about the loss piece of your story, I wondered if you wouldn't mind sharing what has been helpful and what's the wrong thing to say? How can we as a community support women who have gone through this?
Sure. Say the name. Hearing people say Stella's name in conversation, seeing her name written in messages, in cards, in Instagram comments, it just really means so much. It's an acknowledgement of who she is, that she existed, that she was a person. You know, she's not just something that happened and is a really sad story, but she is the story. You know, she's a huge part of my life. And the more people who say her name, the better. I don't want to continue through life where people are dodging that part of who I am. You know, I will never, ever, ever be the same person again. I read something recently and it said something like, loving you changed a huge part of who I am. It's no surprise that losing you has changed who I am as well. I can't remember if those were the exact words, but if you're out there and you're listening and you've got someone in your life who has lost a pregnancy or lost a child, please don't think it'll be awkward by bringing it up. I love talking about Stella. I love saying her name. I love hearing it. That is hands down like the number one piece of advice is talk about it.
And then just thinking about your journey kind of as a whole, what advice would you have for other women who are maybe considering the single motherhood route?
Don't ever feel like you're alone. So you might be doing your journey alone, but you're not alone. There is a whole world of women out there that have either done it, that are thinking about it, that are actively trying for motherhood. There are forums online. Instagram is full of us. There are Facebook groups. I've been to local meetups in my city of other women. I've got a couple of really good friends now who are in this community, and I couldn't have gotten through moments without them, because there is a really unique form of understanding that comes from another individual who's done it or who's going through it and understands. Yeah, you might be alone, but you're not alone.
Thank you so much. Well, before we go, a couple things before we go. I do want to ask, what's next for you?
Yeah, what's next? So I've recently had some conversations with my fertility specialist, my lovely lady fertility specialist that I love. And we have agreed that we won't be doing any more cycles with my own eggs, just because I've had such poor results and such poor quality. So the options there mean either egg donation or embryo donation. My preference is to go down the embryo donor route. That is even harder to do than using a sperm donor. They are very not available. But because I am single, and this is actually a pro to doing this on my own, is I don't have to consider the biological connection to a partner. So with an embryo donation, I'm also skipping ahead through the whole process of egg retrieval and then fertilization, embryo development to 3 days to 5 days to freeze. Embryo donors have gone through all of that. They have completed their families and they're guaranteed good quality. So they're unable to donate anything that's poor quality. Anything that's made it to freeze is generally very good quality. It's also more financially available to me, but the actual availability of the embryos is going to be the hurdle. So I'm hoping to be able to start that next step in a few months' time. I don't feel like I'm ready to start doing anything in the next few months because Stella was due on the 5th of June. It's currently the 3rd of April, so another 2 months. It feels like her time right now. Mm. It's not time for me to be having any more treatment, falling pregnant, focusing on anything else. I need to focus on grieving, on healing, letting my body recover. I'm in a postpartum phase. My period only just came back up until maybe 2-3 weeks ago. I was still lactating. I still had milk coming through. So even though I had a stillbirth at 20 weeks gestation, my body is still recovering from that. I'm still going through all the same postpartum recovery as any other woman that's had a full-term pregnancy. So it's a couple of months ahead of me of healing primarily. And then focusing on finding some embryos, which hopefully there are some beautiful embryos out there that have come from an equally beautiful family that are looking to pass on, I think, what would be the greatest gift. I'm nervous, but I'm excited as well. My heart definitely can't take any more negatives or heartbreak at the moment, but, you know, I'll build up that resilience again and I'll get there.
Yeah, well, we wish you all the best in the next phase. And just thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm sure it will touch so many people and be helpful and meaningful to listeners. So before we go, is there anything else that you want to share?
I think we've covered it all, but maybe just I'd like to say that if anybody out there would like to reach out, you know, if you've got fears or concerns about trying, if you're experiencing your own mental health issues whilst also going through infertility issues, maybe you've also had a stillbirth and you're grieving and you just want somebody like a stranger to talk to, because I know that can also be helpful. I'm here and I'm always happy to listen, to lend an ear, to offer advice. Look me up on Instagram, project.pickle. And reach out. I love talking to new people and listening to their stories as well.
Thank you so much, Krista.
Thank you so much, Katie. And thank you so much for having me and for letting me talk about Stella and to say her name.
Yes.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Single Greatest Choice podcast. I'm your host, Katie B. You can learn about me and this project on my website, singlegreatestchoice.com. That's also the place to go if you're interested in being a future podcast guest. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a minute to rate and review in iTunes. That helps more women to find our show. Until next time, I'm sending you all my love and support as you go about making the choices that will create a life you love.